This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm interviewing David M. Carroll, the author of a beautiful book called Following the Water, A Hydromancer's Notebook. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm very fine. Very fine. Thank you.
Good. It's really a pleasure to talk to you. I read a lot of books. I try to only interview people whose books I really like, and this is one that I really enjoyed a lot.
Well, that's very good news. I'm glad to hear that. I really am.
Well, and so just tell me a little bit about the genesis of this book. I know you've written a number of other books that are about your experience in the wetlands with turtles,
mm-hmm.
But maybe you could talk a little bit about the kind of what the background is for how you set this book up.
Yes, it's an interesting story for me to get into that because the genesis actually has gestation has been a long, slow time in coming, because I originally drafted a chapter 2 for Swamp Walker's Journal, which was my third book. This current book is my fifth. And I had in mind a chapter called Following the Water. And as I was writing that book, I realized a couple of things. One was I was kind of going off drifting off in a different direction with the kinds of things I let come into my mind, the kind of descriptive and then somewhat more meditative writing. There's always a bit of that in my books, but I began to think, wow, you know, that book was really getting to be way over budget, and I knew that. And then I thought, I like this idea, Following the Water. I think that could be a separate book someday. So I pulled it out, and my editor at the time, Harry Foster, who unfortunately I did two books with him, Swamp Walker and Self-Portrait, and then unfortunately he developed brain tumors and died at 62 three or four years ago. He said to me at the time, well, that was my favorite chapter, but I understand why you're doing that. So I had some preliminary notes and drafts, and then the Self-Portrait book came out, and then I felt like I was ready to do another book, and that idea was still pretty much in my mind. And I had been writing a few things here and there over a period of like 15 years with that book in mind, thinking, well, maybe I'll self-publish it if Houghton is interested or not or whatever. But in the meanwhile, the book began to take shape. Houghton Mifflin responded to it very favorably, I was happy to say. And so I began writing it in earnest, and so I was drawing really on some of those drafts that I originally wrote 15 years ago. It would be almost 18 years ago now, and then incorporating new material, and then going out more specifically with that book. When I was in the field, I was thinking in the direction of this book. Usually, when I'm out there, it's largely observing and taking field notes. Then occasionally, you know, letting my mind drift and writing things that I later use in my books. But with this one, I consciously almost tried not to get caught up in just that basic field data that I do, like turtle shell measurements and weights and habitat descriptions, and just let my mind drift more. And I began to like how it was shaping together, and decided that I was looking forward to it because I didn't want to have the burden again of building quite so much natural history background information into it and doing, you know, a lot of that kind of work from my own notebooks. Plus, I do a tremendous amount of review of the scientific literature, and I'm in communication with a lot of other people working with these species. So this was a whole different tangent. And that's kind of where the hydromancer came from. A hydromancer, the idea being that this is one, the word fascinated me, who, there are a number of definitions for it. One is, divines things through observation of water and predicts things. I'm not a seeker, I'm not a predictor, but one of the definitions is that it is one who comes to obscure or hidden knowledges through other than human means.
Well, that actually is a beautiful definition.
I should have probably put it in the book.
Well, you know, it sort of brings to, there are two things I wanted to talk about. One was some of the language in the book. But before I do that, I want to just say to anybody who's listening that what this book does is, it's following you through a period that starts with the spring, essentially, and
mm-hmm.
runs to the to the late fall, early winter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really your kind of the arc of the book is this journey through time, but it's also a journey through the place that you're in. And for people who don't know your work, you're a field naturalist who specializes in, I would say, turtles and, you know, other riparian, you know, water-based animals. And,
right.
So, you know, as you've described it, it's different from kind of strictly biological reporting. It's much more meditative and interior. You talking about your reactions to the things you see, but also your history of working in these places and the relationship that you have to the turtles and to the frogs. I mean, it's a really, you know, it's something I wouldn't try to sum up because I think that would diminish it.
Mm-hmm.
But the language is actually quite beautiful, and you use some really interesting words. One I thought I had to ask about was car, C-A-R-R, because you don't see that word used very often.
No, you don't. Not in English, anyway.
Right.
Or I'm not even sure the derivation of that is obscure. It may be early Scandinavian or Norse or Anglo-Saxon, but it. I love the word, and maybe because that's the first four letters of my name, but I don't really think so, my last name. But I just thought of the alder car. The car, a car is a kind of a wet area with a lot of shrubby growth, seasonal water. The water comes, the water goes. And I can't even remember where I found that definition. It's very, very hard to find a definition for car or even find it in a dictionary. But that was the definition, and I thought that it was such a beautiful word, and it really describes one of the types of habitats that I absolutely love and spend an awful lot of my time in. It rhymes very much with the habitat of the spotted turtle, which is one of the two key species that I follow as I follow the water.
Well, and it seems that, you know, you do have to, for people who don't know the landscape of New England, which is really the one that you're in,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're in New Hampshire, I'd say, you know, kind of, as I was reading it, I didn't realize where you were. You know, I hadn't looked you up. I didn't, you know, try to figure out what you were, where you were situated
before
I read the book.
Yep.
So I actually figured out that it was New Hampshire from the descriptions that you gave based on the seasonality, you know, and how cold and, you know, kind of, you talk a lot about the water entering areas and then leaving, you know, because you have the, you know, the water that comes from the melt in the spring.
Right.
And I think that was pretty evocative. But I also wanted to ask you about what's the difference between a car and a fen?
Oh, they're basically the hydrology is different and the botany is different. So a fen really is what most of us in New England or in the glaciated Northeast would call a bog. And I get into those more in Swamp Walker's Journal in the sense that each chapter we go into a different kind of wetland type. And I do some meditative writing, but I also kind of define the difference between a shrub swamp, a swamp, a marsh, and then peatlands, which are fens and bogs. A fen is a very acidic kind of sphagnum mossy place where there's always water and it's quite occluded, so it's very much deprived of nutrients and so forth. A pure bog is only gets its water from the rain. It's isolated on a mountain catchment or something. It has no groundwater inlet or so forth or outlet. But a fen is really the kind of place where you would see pitcher plants and you would see sphagnum moss and you would see still water. It's a still water wetland. Whereas a car is a place where spring floods move through it. There's standing water 3-4 months out of the year, perhaps. They're typically dry down, where they're always wet-footed. They're always muddy and mucky and full of ferns and rampant growth. But it does have a very different plant profile and a very different hydrology.
Right. No, and I know the fens pretty well from studying bogs in Vermont a little bit. But but those are different, I think, from how you described the car, which I wasn't quite sure of.
Right.
And then I guess there's also another beautiful word, the swale, which is often also not used by people.
No, and I obviously I love that. I love that word. I try not to overuse the words I love, but I put them on my maps. And in fact, in Year of the Turtle, I call this one particular vernal pool habitat the swale. That's probably another kind of Scandinavian or Northern European kind of old word you don't see very often. And it basically means a low, wet place. It's a low place where water collects mostly in the spring with the heavy rains, or if you're far enough north, as you said, with snow melt and so forth. And it has a lot of grassy growth in it. And then that water dries up, it goes away, it has its season, and then it comes back again over the next winter and spring. But the brief definition of it is a low, wet place. So it's kind of a plastic definition that can be molded. But over the years, the places I call swales, and in my own terminology, I've come to my own image of it, I guess.
Well, it's pretty evocative. I think the book does, you know, you get a really strong feeling about the natural landscape in the area that you're in. And, of course, there are a couple of times when you leave. There's one time when you leave the kind of place that the book really takes place in, when you go off to do a study for a group that's looking at another area. Kind of nearby, I guess, and that that's the only time I think in the book where you have contact with directly with the human creations, you know, the people's houses, and but you're still talking in the book a lot about the pressure on landscape and the loss and the, you know, the kind of theme for me was almost this sadness about the disappearance of nature. And I guess maybe, you know, I wanted to ask you about that, you know, because this is, as you said, the book has been written over a long period of time. It does seem more difficult today than it was even 20, 30 years ago to find places which are either, that are not compromised in some way.
It's becoming almost impossible to find a place that isn't compromised or marginalized by the encroachment of human habitation, and then the inroads, the recreational use and so forth that I address in the book. And the book definitely has, in all my books, there is that lament, because I remember when I was writing Swamp Walker's Journal, and I used the phrase landscape of loss, and my editor, Harry, said, you know, I saw one of his delete signs there. He recommended dropping that because I think, in a way, he wanted me to write a You Come Too. A lot of times people read my books and they get more the, kind of a Pied Piper of the swamp idea. And there's also been this landscape of loss, you know. So I left that in. I mean, I had the power of stat, which, you know, is that, maybe that's an incoming. Is that troubling you? That
no.
I don't know where that's coming from. But anyway, so when I was writing Self-Portrait with Turtles and I penned the immortal line, I walk a disappearing landscape, I could see Harry's delete sign even before I sent the manuscript in. But that's been an aspect of the books. And in this one, because the time has passed and because that book started out the way it did, that sadness, that just had to be part of the book. I mean, I couldn't avoid it. And my new editor, Deanne Ermey, who was a great joy to work with, felt perhaps my ending was a little too dark and so forth. And my wife, who's a fantastic in-house editor for me, said, I really love this book. I just hope it's not too dirgy. And I said, dirgy? Didn't you see the bright star at the end? And she said, what bright star? I said, the bright star of hopelessness.
Well, but it's hard not to feel, if you have any sense of the you know, understanding of nature and the, you know, I read a lot of people talk who have been in nature. It's impossible not to call out, it isn't so much a feeling of hopelessness as a feeling of you have to state the danger. It's sort of like what Bill McKibben and Al Gore do. That
right.
It's, you know, the idea is you have to say that this is a critical moment.
Right.
And a lot of this, of course, goes to population. I think you refer to that you know, it's not, we don't have to think about it in any other way than planning how people live on the earth.
well, how they do and how many of them do, and that to me is it's interesting. There was one review, and I can't remember what it was that I received. Talked about my pointing out some of the major issues, but not offering solutions. That, well, any solution I have for overpopulation, society might not be ready for it yet. But you know, I feel that is something that you know, I'm certainly not the only one who sees it that way or feels that way. And I get very impatient now, and I give a lot of talks. I'm backing away from that now for a number of reasons. I can't hear myself saying the same thing again. And I also realize that, you know, it isn't hopelessness exactly, but I don't see any real major change coming until something perhaps dire happens, or I don't see our species making the right kind of species decisions. I don't see the evidence yet of that. Certainly there are people like Al Gore and Bill McKibben and many others, and I mean, Thoreau said this, what, a couple hundred years ago, 150 years ago. Aldo Leopold, I mean, it's, you know, people saw it coming when we could have done things a lot more differently, but we just don't seem to know how to change the track. We cannot get the engine to run on another track. So it's going to have to go somewhere until it just doesn't work anymore, and then it's going to have to be rethought or reimagined. I don't know what.
I tend to agree. I think the evidence is that humans are not capable of recognizing the consequences of their actions enough to be able to act proactively to prevent things from getting worse.
Unfortunately, that's a part of our species behavior and perhaps a dominant one. There just aren't that many people who see the train coming down the track, and I can't believe how surprised they get when the train hits them. You know, there was evidence, and you know, I don't pass myself off as a great look-ahead type person, you know, or a great visionary of any sort. But I mean, this kind of thing that I see and that just drives me to almost sometimes I can hardly go back to the swamps anymore. It's becoming more and more difficult for me. To me, it's as obvious as can be. I mean, you don't have to be a visionary to see what's happened to the planet and what is happening. But it's still a tough sell, and even that thing I do in the last chapter there, which, again, Deanne thought, my editor thought was a little dark, and I looked at it, and I had ended it kind of abruptly, so I wasn't going to throw in rainbows and lollipops. I mean, I said what I said, and that was based on a real-life scenario, an issue that I had, a place that I had been working towards for about 30 years, and it almost looked like we could have a real ecosystem reserve thing there of 2,000 to 4,000 acres. And when the wheels fell off that cart and it went the way that I've always seen things go, that was hard to take. It wasn't a surprise, but it was hard to take. And so I looked at the chapter again, and I remembered what my wife Lorette said about not being too dirgy, and I couldn't change that really, but I amplified it. I wrote around why I came to feel that way. I was saying that. And I think that's okay. But you know, it's interesting. There was one four-page review written in something called Open Letters, a journal that I wasn't familiar with before, where the reviewer, Tuck McFarland, I believe his name was, has a very high regard, very familiar with my work, all kinds of praise for my writing and art and everything, and yet took me to task for some of those issues that I might have thought people would take me even more to task for, like, he is too dark, or he seems to think that the human species does nothing but sleepwalk and nobody's awake to the reality. Well, I'm not a misanthrope, really. I consider myself a humanist, not a misanthrope. But I can't help looking around at what people are doing and looking what's resulting and looking at this incredible compromising and marginalization, and not just that, but the trivialization of nature. And I can't, that doesn't go down, as we say in Spanish, it doesn't fall well on me, and so I have to react to it.
No, I think, to me, it's understandable. I don't, you know, I don't have any problem with how you react and how you feel as a result. And in fact, it almost seems inevitable that the more you're involved in nature, the more difficult it is to accept the inability of humans to recognize nature on its own terms rather than on our own terms.
Yeah, you're saying it exactly correctly, exactly. And indeed, if you don't see nature as something to just take a walk with your dog through while you're listening to your iPod, I mean, you know, if you fall in love with nature, which is what happened to me when I was 8 years old, if you fall in love with it, it's like falling in love with a person or anything, and you see that just being thrashed or whatever, or just slowly being eaten away. I mean, obviously, it's going to affect you.
I think it's inevitable. Let me ask you a couple of other things before we have to end.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I really wanted to know after reading the book, you mentioned early on the devastation of this otter. We assume an otter.
Yes.
Attacking the colony of turtles that you've worked with for all these years, and what the otter does is chew off the limbs, the legs and feet of the turtles.
Mm-hmm.
And there was at one point where you weren't sure whether this was a one-time predation or whether this was something bigger. And I guess I had to ask, you know, since this book finished, do you have a sense that, I mean, is that otter still there? Is this, well, was it a one-time deal? Or?
Well, yeah, that's very, very interesting because, to answer quickly, I am convinced it was an episodic event. I think it's something that might happen, you know, once ever, I don't know how many decades. But for 16 years, the area that I was observing had such a robust colony of turtles with almost zero incidents of limb loss. And, you know, I share this, I discuss this with other people studying wood turtles and so forth, and my area was almost a paradigm for survivorship, for recruitment of juveniles, and for low incidence of predation, for reasons I'll never really fully understand. Then that one year, it tipped that balance extraordinarily, and I think I say in there, I went from, you know, it was very rarely that I would find a wood turtle with a missing foot or a leg, and then all of a sudden, it became rare that I found one with all four limbs, just in one season. Now, that has not happened since then either. I still am finding, in fact, some of those males that lost both of their front legs. Their ability to survive is quite amazing. They've gotten through three or four growing seasons and hibernation seasons now, just, you know, pushing themselves along with their hind feet. I doubt they're able to mate because they don't have those front legs and so forth, as I mentioned in the book. But I am, and in fact, this was kind of an unusual incident with the wood turtle. The otter predation, and it definitely was otters, has been documented with wood turtles, but not a severe hit like that. On the other hand, there have been incidences where colonies of snapping and painted turtles have been absolutely devastated by otters digging them out during hibernation. So it's not an unknown thing, but I wrote this up, and it was published in a scientific journal because it is something of some significance. And one of the things that I do try to keep going back, it's become difficult to go there because of things that have happened, as I mentioned in the book. But I do need to keep going back as long as I can possibly stand it because I have these long-term observations of this one area and this one population of turtles over so much time, and that is something that a lot of people just aren't able to do. You know,
no, that's very special. And I guess the other thing I wanted to say was I loved the image of you walking with your head down. You know, that you're always in observation mode once you've done this.
Yeah.
You know, I started doing that when I was younger, and of course I have not continued, but my sister-in-law is a biologist, and I've watched her, and it was just very resonant for me because I've seen her walking through, she's an ocean biologist, and she
uh-huh.
walks through the tidelands, completely engrossed and looking constantly the way you described yourself, which I thought was really, you know, that is something unusual. We don't look closely. We don't know how to look closely at nature. It's not that easy to do. But the other thing I thought was really great that I just wanted to mention was your description of the water, where at one point you said you couldn't see the color of the water because you're so used to looking through it. And that really stuck with me. I thought that was just really kind of indicative of and evocative of the whole book, that, you know, it really is about a way of seeing and engaging in the natural world that is it's hard for people to do.
Yes, I sort of take it for granted, I think probably because of that experience I had when I was so young, and I just became riveted. I write about that first turtle in Self-Portrait and that experience in some real detail there about, I mean, that literally changed my life that one evening. And I think, you know, again, I didn't have a mentor, I didn't have a guide, I didn't have, you know, someone tutoring me about nature. I came from a town in central Pennsylvania, no contact with nature, had this experience when I got translocated to southeastern Connecticut. And that spellbinding moment with that turtle in the middle, in the center of it, that focused it all for me, I just couldn't get enough of going and looking and going and looking. So even before I even had any inclinations to maybe do field work or do this or do that, it just became a very natural thing, and I began to build those search images. And it's true, the last wood turtle of the year I saw, I almost stepped on, and he was pretty much in plain sight, but I'm looking not far ahead of my toes in this thick car. First of all, it's very difficult to look too far ahead anyway, but I saw this impression, and then I thought, yeah, that is a black bear's footprint there in the mud, and I'm looking at that. Then I just shift my eyes up slightly, and just ahead of me, there's this wood turtle on the edge of the stream bank. And I must have been staring at the black bear footprint for 3 or 4 minutes before I even shifted my eyes.
Well, it is a great thing that you're able to do this, and I think, you know, obviously reflected in your art as well. It's a wonderful book, and I really enjoyed reading it. I love talking to you just now. The book is called Following the Water, A Hydromancer's Notebook. The author's David M. Carroll. And this is David Wilk for Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. Thanks so much, David.